Welcome to Let's Talk Science with Irene Moon. Today our guest is Dave Armitage, PhD student at the University of California, Berkeley. He studied bats and bat behavior at the University of Florida for his master's thesis. Our discussion with Dave today is about bats being good sleepers, to the extent that being a good sleeper even lengthens their lifespan. Dave Armitage. WELCOME.
So are you working on bromeliads?
No, pitcher plants.
Is that right? Pitcher plants.
Yeah, similar.
So what are you doing? You're looking at just the biota inside pitcher
plants? Yeah, I'm basically looking at how resistance to viruses varies over different populations of these plants, and I'm looking at how, like, phages, bacteriophages contribute to nutrient cycling, so throwing in, like, insects, like fruit flies labeled with 15N, and seeing how quickly that gets sucked up by the plant. And then,
wow, that's pretty
exciting. In the presence of bacteria, amoeba, combinations of different things. So it's just, you know, a fun sadistic experiment.
Are you doing it in the field, or are you doing it, like, a lot here?
Both, yeah. I'm doing some field stuff. I haven't really started that yet, but, I mean, last summer I was just, like, doing sequencing of bacteria that were living in the plants and looking for viruses. There's a lot of viruses.
To find out how many species, or to what?
Yeah, to find out, like, which species were in there, whether or not they were coming from the insects that fell in or just kind of getting there from the soil. That sort of thing.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was fun.
But, you know, like, I want to know, do bats have really low blood pressure?
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the interesting things, I guess, about bats and their perception of time, maybe, is the fact that they, like, exist on these kind of two totally different planes of, you know, lifestyle. So, on one hand, they're zipping around, flying around, maybe for a couple hours a night. If you were to measure their heart rate at that time, it might be, like, above or nearing 1,000 beats per minute, which is just, you know, faster, as fast as maybe, you know, a shrew, if you were talking about another small-bodied terrestrial mammal. Super fast heartbeat, super fast metabolic rate. But most of the time, they're actually sleeping or just kind of hanging out in their roosts during the day and at night. And at those times, their heart rate slows down to maybe, I don't know, below 25 beats per minute. And when they're actually hibernating in their caves, in a state called torpor, their heart rate goes...
Torpor?
Yeah, so I'll tell you what torpor is. It's basically...
T-O-R-P-E-R?
T-O-R-P-O-R.
Torpor.
Yeah, so okay. when a bat is hibernating, it's said to be torpid. And the idea behind torpor is the bat is metabolically lowering its body temperature and heart rate to more approximate the ambient conditions. So it's not like a snake where its body temperature is completely determined by its external temperature, but it's actively regulating its temperature to fall below, you know, its active metabolic temperature. So it'd be like if humans, every time they went to sleep, their body temperature fell down to maybe 2 or 3 degrees above the ambient temperature. And the effect of that is their metabolism slows down a heck of a lot. And when they have to wake up from... When they're trying to wake up from such a torpor, they're actually metabolizing a type of lipid or a type of fat tissue that's in their bodies called brown fat, brown adipose tissue. And it's confusing reading this literature because its acronym is BAT, so the bats, BAT, is deteriorating quickly. But the idea is that they have this storage tissue that has... properties that allow it to quickly exit torpor and bring their body temperature back up to normal in a very fast amount of time. And it would take, where it might take, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours and a lot of energy to bring our body temperature up to that without this tissue, they can do it in maybe 10 minutes. So
humans don't have brown adipose tissue, do we?
We do as infants, but as adults, not very much, no.
So this lipid, it has like certain amino acids and things in it that are particularly good, like antifreeze sort of things? Or I mean, what makes it so that it can come out of this torpor faster?
So basically, it's called brown adipose tissue because it's packed with mitochondria, which are the bacterial symbionts in all of our cells that produce energy and produce heat. And they're full of, I believe it's iron, which gives it the brown coloration. And it's also got a ton of capillaries in it, more capillaries in that tissue than you would have in normal white adipose tissue or white colored fat that you see, you know, when you're cutting up pork or something. So that's really the property of the brown adipose tissue that allows it to sort of heat up really quickly and then bring the body temperature of the bat up in a very short amount of time.
So they're actually saying that mitochondria now is a bacterial symbiont?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
I missed that. I totally missed that. Like, that probably was 10 years ago or something.
Yeah, it was like a really contentious theory for a while. The name of the woman who proposed it, it escapes me. But, so she came up with this hypothesis like 20 or 30 years ago, and it finally caught on after we were able to sequence just the mitochondria and show that it came from kind of a clade of bacteria, and it was just a huge horizontal transfer to, the critters that gave rise to all multicellular organisms in the same way that chloroplasts are bacterial endosymbionts of all plants.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, they're finding out Wolbachia now in insects is like often does horizontal transfer, potentially does horizontal transfer to insects to do all kinds of things.
Oh, yeah,
as well,
totally.
Which is pretty wild. But yeah, I guess I missed the whole mitochondrial thing. That's great news. I really like the idea that we have, you know, large numbers of bacterial symbionts.
But yeah, so to talk about the brown fat just a little bit more, when we found out that this white nose fungus was killing off all the bats in North America, so it's the fungus that comes around the bats' rostrum, their nose nasal area, as manifests as kind of a white, just sort of, it basically looks like you took the bat and dipped its face into white paint. And it's killing off a ton of the bats, and one of the mechanisms that's actually killing them is the fact that the brown fat is being metabolized a lot quicker while these bats are torpid during the winter for a period of maybe 3 or 4 months during, you know, the really cold winter. The brown fat basically drains out of the bat's body, so they're forced to wake up really early before the snow melts, and they fly around the cave and realize, oh, there's no insects outside for me to eat, so then they just starve to death.
Wow, so do they think that there's a correlation between the fungus and the brown fat in the sense that is the fungus like feeding on the brown fat, or is it just a bad health all around?
Yeah, so there's nobody's really, I mean, there's a lot of hypotheses about how the fungus might affect brown fat reserves, and we know that brown fat reserves are, you know, the thing that enables them to survive throughout the winter, but there's not yet been, you know, a tie. There's no mechanism known for how this fungus actually contributes to the brown fat disappearing quicker than on a bat without the fungus.
Wow, there was I was in a cave in North Carolina over the holidays, and they had incidents of the white fungus in the cave in North Carolina, which is too
bad. Oh yeah, it's spreading everywhere. I mean, it's now heading west I think they found it in Minnesota, Montana. It's probably not going to get down much south of North Carolina, because I think it can only survive at, or I think it grows best at temperatures of like 10 degrees Celsius, and that's lower than most of the caves generally get down south of the Mason-Dixon line.
And there are bugs flying year-round anyway.
Yeah.
When you start getting that far down.
Yeah, totally.
So, well, that's cool. Okay, so back to bat sleep and brown adipose fat. Mm-hmm. So how long does a bat sleep? Like, okay, so during an average day, does a bat sleep 12 hours? Or do they kind of sleep during just periods of time? They sleep a lot more, like, because they hibernate during the winter. But how much does a bat really sleep?
Well, yeah, so throughout the day, they're generally sleeping and then waking. They don't sleep for a very long period throughout the day. They're not like humans, where we'll just spend maybe 6 to 8 hours per night sleeping. They'll be sleeping for half an hour to an hour, wake up, engage in some social activities. They'll groom each other. They have a lot of social behaviors that they do while they're in their roosts. And then they'll go back to sleep. Generally, they're not in torpor during the day. They're just sleeping. When they enter torpor, it's generally when the temperature goes down. So after maybe a half an hour after sunset, they'll start flying around their roost and leave their roost to go forage. And generally, that activity follows kind of a bimodal nightly activity pattern, meaning that the majority of the bats are foraging maybe half an hour to an hour after sunset, and then they'll go and occupy maybe their roost again, or a different night roost where they'll go back to sleep or go back to feeding their young, and then half an hour before sunrise they'll leave and forage again. And it's kind of remarkable that they only spend maybe 2 hours out of the entire 24-hour cycle foraging, because during that time, because their metabolism is so high, they have to be eating just a ton of insects. So they're actually eating, you know, half of their body weight in 2 hours throughout the entire day.
Of mosquitoes.
Yeah, well, so a little lie that bat biologists like to tell people to kind of get them to build bat houses.
Don't say it. Don't say
okay.
it. Don't say it.
I have to say it. I mean, it's true. Bats really aren't huge predators of mosquitoes. However, they are huge predators of a lot of other crop-damaging insects and stuff. So there's a huge benefit to having bat houses near your house, but it's probably not going to get rid of the majority of the mosquitoes. Maybe spiders. Introducing a ton of spiders to your yard, I think that would be better for the mosquito problem.
I think people would prefer that, too, to have, like, lots of spiders crawling around.
Oh, yeah. I just saw that they discovered a spider in, I think it was in Slovenia, that builds these webs that are like 30 to 40 feet, like across a river, and they can catch bats in them, and they can catch.
Oh yeah, them. It's like what was it? The strong is stronger than what was the, not Teflon, but Kevlar,
yeah.
Or something like that. That's pretty awesome. I wonder what the military application of that's going to be, spinning spider web.
Hopefully, or guns that shoot spider nets at protesters. Yeah.
Yeah, that's next. Did you hear about recently that there's a bunch of research where they're for trauma patients? I guess this was what, Topor, how was it pronounced again? The bat
torpor.
Stasis? Torpor. Reminds me of torpor. That there's a bunch of research where when trauma patients come into hospitals, they're reducing their body temperature really, really far down, like to basically hypothermia, levels of hyperthermia. Because they found that, you know, if someone, you know, gets thrown in a river or something like that after a horrible, like an icy river, after something horrible happens to them, their chances of survival are actually a great deal better.
Oh, yeah.
Than before. So their metabolism slows way, way down, and their blood pressure goes to almost nothing.
Right.
And everything else. And so they're using this as a way now to save, like, severely trauma patients and
mm-hmm.
stuff that have big artery cuts or things like that.
Yeah. I've heard that's the case, because with a lower temperature, your blood is able to hold more oxygen and releases it more slowly. And they say that's one of the reasons that when Rasputin was buried under the ice, he kind of just sat there clawing at the, you know, bottom of the ice for like 15, 20 minutes before he actually drowned.
Wow. That's a picture for me. Yeah.
This was after he was shot and poisoned and beaten and all sorts of things.
Anything else about bats? There's about to be a million other things.
Oh, yeah. Well, one really cool thing about bats is that they have a remarkably long lifespan for their body size. So if you were to compare the longevity of a bat and a shrew, which they're both generally maybe 10, 15 grams in size for the larger shrews, the shrews will live maybe 5-6 months, and they have to be feeding constantly or else they'll die. They'll just freeze to death. Their metabolism is just off the charts. Even for larger bats, comparing them to mice and rats, those things are, mice and rats are living for, you know, on average between 6 months and 1 to 2 years. And small bodied bats that hibernate, so the temperate bat species, can actually live upwards of 30 years in the wild.
Wow. I never would have guessed that.
Yeah. So it's really bizarre how long they can live compared to things of a similar body size. And they think that it's probably due to the fact that they're, you know, for the majority of the year, their metabolic rate is so low that there's not a lot of, you know, sort of protein damage going on from metabolic activities. They say that having a higher metabolism leads to, you know, more DNA damage from byproducts of metabolism. So that's one of the hypotheses. But if you were to graph lifespan out versus body size, so say you have body size on the x-axis and lifespan on the y-axis, you could fit a line, a pretty good line, to the trend for that for all mammals that are not bats. And then if you plot the bats on there, they'll all fall below that line. So what that says is they're living significantly longer than other mammals of the same body size. It's really weird.
Well, that is really weird. Maybe that has to do with hibernation, though, that torpor state. The like you said, so does that, like, bears hibernate, mm-hmm. and other mammals hibernate? Is it sort of a general trend that these things that hibernate have longer...
No, lifespans? Not at all. And actually, another interesting thing is that really only the insectivorous bats, so the ones that are feeding on insects and moths and stuff, those are the ones that are living longer. So frugivorous bats, nectivorous bats, fish-eating bats, vampire bats are all kind of on that line, whereas insectivorous bats are significantly below it.
So are those mostly tropical bats, the non-insectivorous bats?
Yeah, no, not necessarily. Insectivorous bats are just kind of the majority of all bats, but when you're looking at temperate bats, those are almost always insectivorous.
Right. So do the tropical ones actually hibernate at all? Do they go into torpor?
Do the tropical ones hibernate? No, they generally don't. And not all temperate bats hibernate either. Some of them actually migrate.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah, some of them go all the way from North America down to the Caribbean and Central America.
Wow, I didn't realize bats migrate. Mm-hmm. Of course they do. They have wings. Why don't they
yeah,
migrate?
Yeah, I would migrate if I had wings.
Exactly. What else about bats that I was really... So we have to talk about vampire bats for a second.
Okay.
Because, you know, that's what everyone wants to know about vampire bats. Like, I want to know about vampire bats. Are they the only blood-feeding or mammal body fluid-feeding bat?
Are the vampire bats the only bats that feed on bodily fluids? That's a good question. As far as I know, yes. There are no other sanguivorous mammals.
Right. You know, there's a couple of moths that are lactophagous, that, like, they suck the eye juices out of cows and stuff like that. And there's even this one Asian moth that they think it's in the same family as the lactophagous ones, but the eye juice moth that will pierce the skin of, like, soft tissues, particularly in between the fingers or toes or something, and drink blood from there. So it's happened. The vampire moth has happened before too.
That's cool. Yeah, I can't think of any other mammals that are primarily sanguivorous, but I mean, there's a lot of things that, you know, they'll drink blood if they have the chance. But there's also multiple species of vampire bats. So there's, I think, 3 species. And then there's also all of these bats called false vampire bats. And one of the coolest bats, so my favorite bat is a South American false vampire bat. Its scientific name is probably the coolest scientific name ever, Vampirum spectrum.
And, oh, that's pretty good.
And it's also the world's largest echolocating bat. So bats generally fall into 2 main groups, the echolocating bats, which are smaller, the ones you typically see, you know, around flying around your house. And then there's the non-echolocating bats, or the mega bats, which are the flying foxes that have, you know, 5-foot long wingspans. But
the flying chihuahuas.
Exactly. Yeah. They look like dogs with wings. They're terrifying, but they only eat fruit. But this bat, Vampirum spectrum, is about as large as a medium-sized flying fox. It's got a wingspan of maybe, let's say, 4 feet, and it eats meat, so it can catch rodents and other bats and just devour them. It's one of the scariest-looking bats.
Do they hunt in packs at all, or are they solitary? Because that would be really terrifying if they actually, like, hunt in packs.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of bats that do feed in big groups. Usually they'll fly out of a cave together and then form smaller kind of satellite groups around the main one. But it varies by species. I don't think the false vampire bats forage in groups.
What is the oldest known bat? Like, when did bats first emerge on the scene? Like, how long have they been around?
Oh, yeah. So the fossil record for bats is really sparse. I mean, there's barely anything. The first bat fossil came from, I think, the Eocene, which dates maybe 50 million years ago. So, and this bat was fully developed. Like, this looks like a... Basically,
it's not a proto bat in any way.
No, not at all.
It's like a bat.
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to, just by looking at it, it looks identical to a flying fox. So yeah, probably frugivorous, but who knows? And so there were probably bats before then, but we just don't have any fossils from them.
Right. Probably because they weren't hanging around things that were typically like fossil making, you know, like bogs and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, and yeah. I mean, so one of the other ideas about why bats don't live for a very long time is because they don't really have, there's not really many ways for a bat to die. So, I mean, they can die from this new white nose disease that's killing them all, but I mean, there's not many predators of bats. It's hard for birds to catch bats because bats are so maneuverable, and there's not many predatory birds at night other than owls. And actually, in places where there are no predatory birds, a lot of bats can fly around during the day. So if you go to, I think it's Easter Island, there's no hawks or anything around during the day, so you can actually see bats that use echolocation, so they don't generally fly during the day anywhere else, but they do when there's no predators around.
Wow. I saw a video... When a nature documentary or something like that of a cave, and these hawks, they were like red-shouldered or red-tailed or something along those lines. Hawks had learned to catch bats out of the air, and so they were flying, and then they would, you know, fly with their talons up, basically, and try to catch. But it wasn't really fair, because it was like a huge mass exodus of bats out of a cave, and so if you just hold your talons up, you're gonna get something, you know?
Yeah, I've also seen snakes hanging out at the mouth of caves that are just able to grab bats out of the air. It's pretty cool.
Just striking anything.
Yeah, basically.
Right?
Hoping their teeth hook on, sink into the flesh.
Well, that's cool. How many species, how many kinds of bats are there?
I think there's somewhere around 950 to 1,000 species. So
that's all. That's not too many.
Yeah, they're actually the second most diverse group of mammals, next to rodents. But rodents outnumber bats. I think there's 2,500 species of rodents around there. So
do they think bats are derived rodents?
So yeah, that's a big question nowadays. They really think. I could be totally off base on this, but I think they think that bats are now more closely related to primates, actually. So prosimians, things like lemurs and afrotheres, so things like tree shrews and aardvarks now, than
That's
rodents,
weird.
Yeah.
That's really weird. I guess they never would have guessed that with morphology, studying their physical structures. That was mostly done through DNA work, I would imagine.
Yeah, but I mean, there's really nothing to compare them to that's alive today, because there are a few like proto gliding mammals, but so they used to think that things like the flying lemur gave rise to bats because it is the mammal that glides around the most. But it turns out that that's not right, and there's just no contemporary sort of progenitor of bats that's really evident these days.
Right, just a lot of extinction in between. Mm-hmm. So those fossil bats, what continent were they on? Like, where do they think bats might have arisen?
Oh, nobody knows. I have no idea where they could have arisen. There's no evidence for them arising anywhere.
Okay. All right. Well, that was mostly my questions. Is there anything else about bats you want to talk about, or did we hit on most of the hot bat topics?
I actually have some pretty cool bat quotes here that I found in this old book, Bats.
Who was the author of that book?
Glover Morrill Allen.
Yeah, what's the year?
Oh, 1939.
No, go. Oh, yeah, that's a good year for quotes.
Yeah, and so I was just looking through a chapter entitled "Some Strange Uses for Bats," and here's just a couple really really interesting uses for bats. If you cut off the head of a live bat, tie it up in black skin, and place it by the left arm of anyone, he will not sleep until it is removed.
Well, I can best believe that.
Yeah.
I don't think that is, in question whatsoever.
Yeah, okay. Here is a prescription whereby a woman may attract herself to the man she desires. Take the eyes of a bat while it is still alive, then let it go. Then take uncooked flour or unrefined wax and fashion a little dog and insert the right eye of the bat into the dog's right eye and the left likewise into the left. Manipulations are then made with a needle. The eyes are sealed in a vase, and the whole is thrown down at a crossroads. If you want to bring him, you shall succeed.
That's weird. So what is this guy, was he serious in uses of bats? Or is he just, he's just showing what, like, people have
used? Yeah, it's sort of an ethnographic chronology of the uses of bats that he's found throughout time, and it's interesting, so most of them have to do with either vision problems or sleep problems.
Right, because they're night flyers, yeah. And that people assume they can see really well because they can fly around at night.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we could talk about echolocation for a second.
Yeah, sure.
So dolphins do it, right?
Right.
Do they do it the same way as bats?
No, not at all. Bats actually have many different ways they echolocate, so certain bats can only produce echolocation calls from their nostrils. So they're basically, I mean, you can kind of imagine trying to do this, make a clicking noise that you can kind of feel in your nostrils.
I bet you spend a lot of time trying to do that.
Oh yeah. I mean, I've seen people who claim to be able to echolocate. I'm not sure I believe them. But okay, so there's the nasal echolocating bats. There's bats that don't echolocate at all. Then there's bats that echolocate with their vocal cords, and that's generally how the pinnipeds do it. They're echolocating with their vocal cords, but it's not really coming out of their mouth. It's just kind of being projected forward from their face. It's a very different way of doing it, and the way that they detect it is also different because bats, I mean, if you picture a bat, you're picturing a thing with tiny eyes and giant ears. So they're picking up the echolocation signals generally through their ears and also through the crazy lobes that they have on their face, because a lot of bats have like satellite dish shaped features on their face that are really good for picking up sounds. And dolphins are actually picking up sound through their lower jaw. So so their lower jaw vibrates, and their lower jaw is actually connected to their ear bones. I mean, that's where our ear bones are derived from, reptilian lower jaws. So it's a lot different in how they receive that signal, and then the processing is very different too. I mean, I'm no expert on it, but as far as I know, it's totally different.
So you were saying earlier that not all bats actually echolocate, though. That the frutivorous ones, I guess it doesn't make any sense for them to. It's not a moving target, and
yeah, they really
they have
don't.
Big eyes, and
they just visualize the fruit and fly to it. They don't, and they generally don't fly at night. There's a few flying foxes that do echolocate, but most of them are diurnal and just have really big eyes, really good vision.
So what is the state of bats in this world? Are bats doing really well, or bats having a hard time?
Depends really on where you are looking, but I would say that in Europe, the UK, for instance, there are just not very many bats there. And it's surprising because there's not really a reason why bats shouldn't be as common in the UK and Europe as they are in the United States. But one of the theories is that white nose syndrome has actually already spread throughout Europe and historically, maybe a few centuries ago. And so the lack of bats you see in Europe is kind of an artifact of white nose syndrome, and that's going to be mirrored in the United States now. There's also Pacific Islands where people harvest bats to eat. So there's in the same way that they harvest, I think it's swallows' nests, cave swallows, where they take the nests out of the caves to make soup. Basically it's like secretion. They make this secretion that keeps the nests all together, and apparently it's a delicacy in a lot of Southeast Asian countries. And so while they're up there on those ladders, they also take all the bats they can get and fry them on sticks. I've seen fried bats on sticks in Thailand.
Try one?
No, I thought about it, but I mean, it's not a good idea to eat bats. They're vectors for all sorts of horrible parasites.
Ah, like what?
People have now said that Marburg virus, a virus that is very similar to Ebola, that has had a few outbreaks in Southeast Asia and Europe, that is actually derived from bats. SARS, people think now bats
came from bats.
Bats might be a vector for SARS.
Well, this actually might corroborate the theory that they are closer related to primates, right?
Yeah.
Does that?
Maybe. I mean, I'm not sure. Bats also carry all these different strains of rabies that can easily be transmitted to certain carnivores over other things. But I don't think that really, I don't think that's strong evidence for phylogenetic similarity. I mean, we don't know yet.
Right. So do bats sometimes get mistakenly killed a lot because they're considered these disease carrying creatures that, you know, like people kill them because they're scared they're going to transfer rabies or something like that?
But it's really hard to kill a bat. I mean, it's hard to, you know, aim your gun and shoot at it because it's flying all over the place at night. So they're not really as persecuted as, say, I don't know, snakes. When you see
right.
a snake, you stomp on its neck. But there are some instances. So, like, there's this species of bat called the gray bat, which is probably the most endangered bat in the United States, or one of them. And there was just an incident where one of the last cave roosts that you can find these bats in, I think it was in Kentucky, some rednecks went in there and threw rocks and killed all the bats in there. And they were quickly brought to justice. They're actually, one of them's in jail for, I think, 3 to 5 years now for killing those endangered bats. But generally, people just, you know, kill bats when they fly into their house.
Right. So the flying foxes were under some persecution for a while, weren't they? They were being killed for some reason or another?
Oh, yeah. It's because, yeah, so flying foxes, especially on big farms in Southeast Asia again, in Indonesia, there's actually, these bats are eating all the figs, so it pays to, I guess, exterminate them from, you know, one of these fig plantations. And another weird thing is that those figs that the bats were eating, a lot of them were dropping to the ground, and then people were collecting them and pigs were eating them. And the figs that the bats had chewed on and dropped, some say that that's actually where, I forget if it was SARS or West Nile virus, but it was some pandemic started was because they were feeding on the figs that were dropping from the trees and then pigs and humans were eating them.
Oh, wow. Transferred to the pigs or maybe then cross-transferred to Wow. Wow, that's interesting. Well, you studied bats for your master's work.
Yeah.
Right? And you did for 2 or 3 years you were studying bats mm-hmm. in northern Florida. And you were studying sound variation or call variation amongst one species of bat or multiple species?
Right. So basically what we were trying to do was figure out how prescribed fire, which is used as sort of a habitat management protocol, affected the bats, because nobody really knew how, you know, burning swaths of forest was going to impact bats at all. So we deployed what are called bat detectors, which record echolocation calls. And then, you know, in these different treatments that had been burned maybe once every year, once every 5 years, patches of forest that never had been burned, and just compared which species were feeding there most often, and kind of tied that into the morphology of the species. So, for instance, in forests that are burned more often, they have a more open understory, and which allows larger-bodied bats and bats that have particular flight physics to forage there more efficiently, because they can't go and fly around these really dense, densely foliated patches of forest. So it seems that prescribed fire is probably good for promoting foraging habitat for a wide range of different body plans that the bats around Florida and everywhere have. And then we were also looking to figure out an algorithm to identify bats to species based on their echolocation calls. So we did that. We wrote a paper on it, and I was trying to apply this algorithm to bird calls and get like an iPhone app that you could use to identify bird calls with, because when you see a bird, maybe you don't know what species of bird it is, so maybe you could record the call of it, and then, you know, your iPhone or whatever would tell you what species it is. And I never got around to it, but it turns out somebody did it like 2 months ago, so
oh wow,
an app coming out that actually can identify bird calls, and maybe bat calls or frog calls or something will be next.
Well, I'm going to play as part of the radio show a bunch of the bat calls that you sent me.
Oh yeah, cool.
This recording starts with a southeastern bat, Myotis austroriparius, and is interrupted by a Brazilian free-tailed bat, Tanarina brasiliensis. This recording is a good sequence from a Brazilian free-tailed bat searching, approaching, and capturing a prey item. The zip sound you hear is known in the bat world as a feeding buzz.
So some identification calls in case somebody has their bat detector out and about, so they can maybe detect the bat sound.
Yeah, yeah. They're actually really easy to build. I mean, you can go online and find plans to build a really cheap and simple bat detector for not very much money. And you just need some minimal like soldering skills. You built one, didn't you?
I did build one. It was better at detecting keys than bats, though. If you like jingle your keys, it makes like sound.
Oh yeah, and actually, if you take your forefinger and thumb and rub them together against your ear, that kind of approximates what a bat sounds like. So
really?
Yeah, it'll make a lot of ultrasonic sounds and not very much audible sound. And if you were to hold that up to a bat detector and do that, it would identically match, you know, the auditory range of bats between 40 and 100 kilohertz.
If there's a bird in the room, like a territorial bird, and you play a bird sound, mm-hmm. then another bird is going to be like, "Hey, what are you doing in this room?"
Yeah.
But if there's a bat in the room and you play a bat sound, does it attract other bats of the same species, or they just don't care, maybe?
Because
it's for different reasons.
So bats have kind of two different types of calls. They have the social vocalizations, which are a lot lower on the frequency spectrum, so they're generally audible by humans. They sound like chirps and that kind of thing. But the echolocation calls are not audible to humans. And there's a lot of work being done now. Actually, not a lot of work, but I mean, people have built bat echolocation call synthesizers that can synthesize a fake echolocation call. And they put that out by like a MISNET that they use to trap bats. And apparently, when they have this thing out playing these bat calls, more bats are attracted to the net, so they catch more bats that way than if they just didn't have them.
So maybe the bats are assuming that since other folks are echolocating in this area, there might be a lot of stuff to eat.
Yeah, exactly. But nobody's really tested that in a thorough way. I mean, maybe there's just more insects in that area than other areas, or it could be a lot of different things.
Anything else you want to say about bats?
If a bat bites you, please go get rabies shots.
Okay. Public service message.
Yep, public service announcement.
David Armitage.
And rabies vaccinations aren't that bad anymore. They're not in your stomach. They're just in your arm.
But rabies is a bad way to go.
Oh yeah. It's the worst way to go. There's probably no disease worse than rabies. I mean, it's just awful.
How many people die? I bet there's a lot of people that die of rabies every year that you just don't hear.
Oh yeah,
about
in
so much.
Third world countries, I'm sure. I mean, whenever you travel to African countries, you're always required to get rabies shots.
Prior to going?
Yeah. Well, no, I guess they recommend it. I guess it's recommended. If you're working with mammals at all, you have to have rabies vaccinations. But I mean,
I know you had to for working with bats. I know that.
Yeah, but I mean, generally, I don't really know that many people die of rabies in like Europe or the United States every year. It's probably only a handful.
So I used to hear that the reason your dog or cat had to go into quarantine if you moved them to the United Kingdom was to prevent rabies from being in the United Kingdom. Do they have rabies in the United Kingdom, or is it?
Oh, I think they would have to. I mean, perhaps not. So there's different strains of rabies. There's rabies that carnivores like skunks and raccoons carry, and then there's sort of bat-specific strains of rabies. But those can be transferred to other groups of mammals. They can be transferred to humans. But I mean, bats are just so ubiquitous, and they go all over the place, so I don't see why.
And they fly across water,
yeah.
So they would fly across channels and things like that.
Yeah, so I would expect rabies to exist in the UK, but maybe it doesn't. That'd be interesting.
That's what I'd always heard, but I never like knew that it was real or not. Okay, well, Dave, thanks for talking to us.
Yeah, no problem.
Thanks for the interview. And what university are you at now? Where are you now?
Oh, I'm at UC Berkeley in California.
Do you have a website or something in case you wanted to advertise yourself?
I don't have a website.
Do you have any extracurricular activities that you do that you want to tell people about?
Besides my Italo disco DJing and noise music, not really. But
you're still doing the Italo disco DJ on the air, on the interwebs, aren't you?
I mean, I don't really have a radio show right now. I used to do a radio show called Phasers to Stunna on Grow Radio, which is the greatest radio station in Florida. Got to give a shout out to that.
Okay, there you go. Grow Radio. All right, that's it. I'm going to turn the recording off.